Hello and welcome to another edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Powell. After more violent attacks on refugees, there are renewed calls to close the Australian-run detention camp on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. The Director of Legal Advocacy at Australia's Human Rights Law Centre, Daniel Webb, says the men in the camp are in Australia's care and they must be taken to Australia for their own safety. He told Don Wiseman that during a trip to Manus last week, he saw a graphic example of the violence the refugees have to contend with.
I was waiting with a group of refugees for the bus that takes them back to the detention centre on a Wednesday afternoon. This was in broad daylight in the middle of the main town there, and then two refugees walked past us towards the police station, very badly injured. They'd been attacked on the street by seven locals who were armed with an iron bar, and they were clearly in a bad way. One of them had very bad cuts to his head and to his arms. He was covered in blood, and when he went inside to the police station, he collapsed unconscious on the floor and had to be driven off to the hospital.
And do we know what the attack was about?
I did have the chance to speak with him a couple of days after the attack when he was released from the medical centre at the detention camp. He's a guy that tries to stay healthy and he likes multivitamin tablets. They're not allowed to take vitamin tablets into the detention centre for some strange reason. So he'd gone into town to buy some vitamins and then buried them on the beach, hid them on the beach. And he was walking with his friend back to the place where the bus picks them up when they were surrounded by a group of seven men, insulted, robbed and attacked. And he told me that he feared for his life and the attack only ended when another local man very bravely intervened to save them.
When you went to the camps, what sense did you get that this is not something out of the ordinary?
I wasn't actually allowed into the detention centre, unfortunately, but I did have the chance to spend several days interviewing many of the men who've been warehoused on Manus for the last 3 years. And I met some amazing people, a guy who spoke seven languages, people of different ages from all over the world with incredible stories to tell. But what they all had in common is they were fearful. What they all had in common is a story to tell about violence both inside the detention centre and outside of the detention centre. So they are living with this daily anxiety of danger, and after 3 years of that, they are exhausted.
The camp on Manus Island has been declared illegal by the PNG courts. Australia is remaining intractable on it. I think there's going to be another sitting by the Supreme Court in a week or so. But what's your feeling about what's going to come next?
Well, I think the Papua New Guinean courts seem very keen to enforce their own orders, and so they should be. Australia has used PNG sovereignty as a shield to deflect responsibility and blame away when bad stuff happens. So there would be something quite fitting about Papua New Guinean sovereignty and the rule of law being the sword to strike a blow at the core of Australia's offshore detention arrangements. More broadly, it's really clear these camps are dead ends. I mean, you've got 1,000 men who've been warehoused in harmful and unsafe conditions for 3 years. 3 years, it's such an incredibly long period of time. They're on a painful road that leads nowhere. And I think whatever the policy challenge the government is trying to solve, deliberate cruelty to innocent people is not the solution. It's well and truly time for the Australian government to bring these men back to Australia.
Questions are being raised about New Zealand spending millions of dollars on an airport development in Solomon Islands when the airport will still not be fully usable. New Zealand Aid has allocated more than $22 million US for infrastructure projects in Solomon's western province. While the country's tourism hub is home to world-class diving and beautiful lagoon resorts, it is certainly not the most accessible of the Pacific destinations. The New Zealand Aid program aims to help change this, but the key airport development will still be incomplete and will only be useful in emergencies. Corey Hawkins reports.
$10 million US of the funding has been spent on upgrading a domestic runway servicing the western provincial capital of Gizo and on an overland road from the international port of Noro to Munda. But the main focus has been the upgrading of the airport on Munda, with $6 million US already spent on extending and upgrading the runway, and a further $6 million approved this year for navigational lighting, a perimeter fence, and two second-hand fire engines. Despite the massive injection of aid funding, the airport will still not be a fully functioning international airport until a terminal is built, and that is not on the plans.
To put it in perspective, it's more than we spent in Cook Islands in the 2014-2015 financial year.
Terence Wood is a research fellow at the Australian National University and a contributor to the New Zealand Aid Development Dialogues. He is sceptical about the return on investment from the Western Province infrastructure project.
So, I mean, for that amount of money, you'd want to see some major economic dividends from the Munda runway for Solomon Islands, and the trouble is that we haven't yet, and we probably never will.
The chief executive of Solomon Airlines, Gus Krause, has also expressed reservations about the usefulness of the airport. He says what he finds odd is that no one is talking about the need for an international terminal at Munda.
People seem to be not trying to put the airport terminal into the equation, but there's no point in landing a jet there without proper facilities to cater for them, whether they're there to wait or clear customs or immigration or whatever is the requirement. You've got to have a terminal that can take that size airplanes.
But in the Western Province, the airport development is being received with much excitement.
The opportunity is phenomenal. I think any operator within close proximity of the Munda airstrip will definitely see the benefits of this.
Belinda Botha is the owner of Dive Munda. Her operation is 5 minutes walk from the apron of the newly upgraded Munda airport.
It not only has great potential for growing and expanding our guests and our tourism base, but also creating new opportunities. So we're all very, very excited about the prospect, and we are looking forward to expand our business.
But this expansion could still be a long way off for local tour operators like Ms. Botha, as even with the additional upgrades scheduled for completion in June next year, the Munda Airport will only be attaining emergency alternative status. However, New Zealand High Commissioner Marion Crawshaw says there will be immediate benefits from the upgrade, especially to airline operators who currently have to carry up to 3 tons of extra fuel per flight because the closest emergency alternative runway to the Honiara International Airport is 2 hours away on the island of Santo in Vanuatu.
So that will enable them to carry more freight and or passengers, and it improves substantially the financial viability of the airline, which we hope eventually will bring down the cost of fares.
But Solomon Airlines' Gus Krause says he does not foresee any change being made to airfares as a result of these economic benefits to the airline.
In the long-term future, if Munda became a real international airport with proper tourism infrastructure built in the western area, once there's more people flying into Solomon's and the airplanes fuller, then we can translate that into some savings to the travelling public.
The head of the Western Provincial Government, however, is unfazed by the considerable investments which would need to be made to enable Munda to become an international airport, including a terminal. Premier Wayne Maipio says his province already has the only other international seaport in the country at Noro, which, thanks also to the New Zealand aid project, is now linked by an upgraded overland road to the Munda airport.
This is a very important infrastructure development, and government will meet.
This is a very important infrastructure development, and my government wants them to quickly finish it so that it can be used to further the development of our province in the west.
Terence Wood argues that trying to improve and promote international flights into the country is like putting the cart before the horse.
But these are not the main impediments to tourism or to exporters in Solomon Islands, so they're not the main impediments to economic development in Solomon Islands. The main problems are local infrastructure, like ports and shipping lines, and other issues such as clarity of land tenure.
The Solomon Islands Permanent Secretary of Aviation, Moses Verivolomo, says his ministry is committed to ensuring New Zealand's investment in the sector is not for nothing.
We plan to develop the aviation sector, and currently we are setting up a SOE to run airport management sector, and we are looking at helping reforms in the airline as well. Other airlines will come, but if we have a functioning airline, then it can fly to places that we want to fly. So all these things come together.
Meanwhile, New Zealand is in talks with the Solomon's government about upgrading 3 more provincial airports to enable them to take larger domestic aircraft. This is Koroi Hawkins.
Oppressive religious beliefs are among the biggest barriers towards ending violence against women in the Pacific. Practitioners and policymakers have gathered in Fiji at the 7th Pacific Women's Network Against Violence Against Women meeting to examine the status of women. The coordinator of the Fiji Women's Crisis Center, Shamia Ali, says that while the status of women has improved, they still face the same issues of oppression and gender equality when the network was established 24 years ago. She told Daniela Medecox, one of the main issues is people interpreting the Bible to suit their own ends.
It's about maintaining the status quo, the gender roles of men and women, not recognizing gender equality, using Bible verses inappropriately to ensure that women remain in the roles that they've been subjected to. And also the issue of reconciliation, keeping the families together, but not doing anything about women's lives and the torture and the violence and everything else that they go through in their own homes.
So people are taking liberties with the interpretation of Bible verses to support their own beliefs.
Yes, yes, that has been an ongoing issue. And then sometimes also the whole use of culture and religion. So almost like they are interchangeable. Religion has become part of the culture, or some cultural aspects and traditional practices have become part of religion. And mix that up with the patriarchal nature of our societies, it's quite lethal.
So how do you even start to tackle that?
Well, there are, you know, today we had a presentation from the House of Sarah, the Anglican Diocese, the Polynesian Diocese of the Anglican Church, and they are doing a lot of work around this and getting other mainstream churches on board. A difficult area, of course, are the newly emerging churches, which are away from the mainstream and are a lot more fundamentalist and haven't actually in any way even shown any signs of embracing the issue of women's human rights or ending violence against women.
Are the churches helping to spread this message?
Yes, they are actually. That the Anglican Church in Fiji, the Diocese of Polynesia, they actually have passed a resolution to do this and are taking action. Recently, the Methodist Church in Fiji has got a code of conduct for its priests and is working on ending violence against women, have started work on it already with their priests, undergoing training in the area, and we also have the Pacific Conference of Churches that for the first time held a male advocacy for women's human rights training for its priests, pastors, as well as deacons and youth who work with the churches.
Is this being discussed in services as well?
Yes, they are doing that. They're preaching from the pulpit also, you know, they're holding special days in churches, Mother's Day, International Women's Day, and so on, to, you know, promote gender equality, but also talk about ending violence against women. Another problematic area with the church is the fact that though they might want to talk about ending violence against women, they fail to address the inequalities within the hierarchy of the churches, the roles that women play, are not allowing women to become a priest, and the things like that. But, you know, though the Methodist Church for the first time is allowing its deacons to sit with the decision makers at its conference, there's still a lot of work to be done there because one cannot talk about ending violence against women without talking about gender equality.
A Spanish tourist was arrested by Indonesian police for attending a Free West Papuan rally in June and is still coping with the release of his private details by police to the press. Thousands of people in West Papua held rallies across the country in several Indonesian cities in June to call for self-determination for the West Papua's full membership of the Melanesian Spearhead Group. 28-year-old Andrea Ranul says he was visiting West Papua when he went to watch a rally, which took place near where he was staying in Jayapura. He shared his experiences with Indira Stewart.
Basically, I heard there was a demonstration going on. And yeah, as curiosity, I went to take a look, take some pictures, interact with the people. So my surprise is when I was getting closer, I wanted to take some pictures, and some guy grabbed me. He was wearing plain clothes. I guess it was a police. Yeah, and after some small struggle, they took me to the police, office, and they started asking me why I was there and everything.
So we'll just backtrack a bit there. So you weren't participating in the rally and the demonstration. You just attended and you were observing.
Yeah, my first intention was just to be as an observer.
So when the police did come up to you, had they given you a warning first? Had there been any kind of communication before you were arrested?
No, that was the funny thing. As I was approaching, I was taking pictures to the police, uniform police. They would do nothing. When I started to try to take pictures of the demonstration itself, is when this plain clothes police took me.
And when you were arrested, can you describe to us what happened?
So basically it's quite strange when you get arrested in Indonesia. So they start asking questions in the basic English, so somebody will come and ask the same questions again and again and again. They start taking all my belongings, taking pictures of it. Yeah, I tell them I was a tourist and visiting.
How long were you detained by police?
At the beginning it was one morning. Then I was processing my passport to go to Papua New Guinea. So I had my passport on the consulate, so I told that to the police. So next day I went to get my passport and the police was there. So they took me again and they did a proper interrogation. And that was almost one day of interrogation from maybe 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. I was staying with a host and it was the night after the interrogation that he told me that the police had leaked my details to the press. So it was all over the news because the police leaked my name, my photo, my details. Yeah. Now if you Google my name, it's all on the details. My friend back at home got the news as well because it was translated to English, to Catalan, to Spanish.
While you were detained and they were interrogating you, can you describe what the experience was like?
They treat me well, no problem, no violence, no, they are not trying to scare me. Also, I was really relaxed, so no, because for me I didn't do anything wrong. They were convinced that I was a journalist passing as a tourist, and that's completely illegal, and they were trying to push me if I was or not, like that.
How do you feel about the Indonesian police releasing your details to the press?
That was... I'm really protective about my details, my personality, my privacy, and that was terrible. It was quite an experience as well, because the same way I didn't expect to be detained, I didn't expect my details to be leaked. So yeah, this is an eye-opener of how things work there. The police can do whatever they want. They don't really care much about your own personal safety or anything.
Do you feel quite helpless at the fact that you can't do anything about your experience and the fact that your personal private details were leaked to the media?
Well, I think I can have some tools to remove that if I need in the future. So far, I'm still coping with it, how it's going to affect me in the future, and any people that looks at my name will find that, and it's going to be linked with me for a long time. I didn't do anything wrong. It shouldn't happen, of course.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The Marshall Islands has been told that achieving the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals will be difficult unless the quality of data can be improved. That was the message highlighted at a meeting last week in the capital, Manjaro. The Marshalls managed to achieve just two of the Millennium Development Goals and is now faced with the challenge of implementing and assessing the 17 SDGs. Our Marshall Islands correspondent, Giff Johnson, told Don Wiseman that a critical factor is lack of resources for delivering the correct statistical information to the Planning and Statistics Office so decisions can be made on the allocation of funds.
They don't have very many staff. They have difficulties getting information from a number of the agencies related to government. And sometimes even where there is data, like they referred to databases on live births, they said actually they found out that there are three different databases being managed on live births, none of which agree with the others. You know, it's a big challenge to go through and evaluate and deal with both the lack of data and the unreliability of data.
So what are they going to do about it? Can they do anything about it?
Certainly things can be done about it, and the planning office says that it has requested funding in the new fiscal year budget to hire two additional people. My feeling is probably they need more than that.
One would imagine a whole lot more. There are so many processes in terms of this data collection, aren't there? They couldn't possibly do it with two additional staff.
I think possibly there is maybe an underappreciation for the value of statistics and analysis. And, you know, this is one of the big challenges for people concerned with trying to promote performance and performance-based budgeting and policies. You know, this is something that takes time to people to move forward and appreciate how data can help to sharpen the focus and inform where budget support should be put. But at the moment, this gathering with the UN and the government agencies and ministries really highlighted that data is a gap in going forward on the Sustainable Development Goals.
The onus really is going to be on donors and organizations like the UN to step up here, isn't it?
The UN people who were at this consultation in Majuro said they were prepared to provide technical support and advice, and already the Pacific Community, SPC, they provide an awful lot of support for statistics collection and particularly for analysis. So there's already a significant amount of involvement from regional and international organizations. I think a key point was brought out by one of the advisors to the Marshall Islands Planning Office, which is they've got so few staff, and so trying to build so-called capacity when you only have a single staff person or a couple of staff people, you can only build so much capacity in one person or two people. You simply have to get the numbers of people who are there, who are qualified, and then can really be trained up to manage the data.
Fiji's tourism industry is revealing in the country's rugby sevens team win at the Rio Olympics last week. The industry says the gold medal is a big boost for brand Fiji, which is still recovering from Cyclone Wilson. Sally Round has more.
The head of tourism Fiji, Matt Stokel, says the win struck a chord with many people.
This is such a huge opportunity for us, and I think the story for us is just beginning. People have really seen the professionalism of the Fijian players and just how humble they were.
The win was reported by media around the world, as was the way the Fiji team received their medals on bended knee from Princess Anne. A strategic communications specialist in Fiji, Patricia Malam, says people's curiosity has been piqued by the team's behaviour.
It is very heartwarming for us that the international audience is taking an added interest. You know, they're looking beyond that whole, oh, there's the cover ceremony and the people in the grass skirt. It is really nice to be able to see them taking an additional interest in the other facets of the Fijian culture.
After the win, Google announced the word Fiji was the number one trending search around the world. And Matt Stokel says the victory caused a huge spike in visits to the Tourism Fiji website. He says the agency's already beefed up its social media marketing around the win.
First, people will go online and they'll have a look and research about the destinations. And of course, we'll leverage off this opportunity through our social media, and we'll have a digital campaign in market soon to try and convert that awareness and intention to visit into getting people here and putting some heads on beds.
Demend Gounder runs the Fiji Tourism Action Group, which was reactivated after Cyclone Winston hit in February to help boost tourism. He says tourism's been recovering well, but this win is a huge boost for brand Fiji in key markets like Australia.
In Australia at the moment, a television station is running a best Olympic moment of the day, and Fiji received 60% of the votes. So a lot of emails, a lot of interest.
Patricia Malam says operators need to strike while the iron's hot.
When we're thinking of projecting ourselves into the international arena, using the team, the key players who have managed to achieve this for Fiji, it would be wise to use them as well, incorporate them into the messaging related to Fiji. They're ambassadors.
Over the weekend in Fiji, celebrations continued as people reviewed and analysed the game. A spokesperson for the Methodist Church in Fiji, the Reverend James Bagwan, says rugby is second only to faith in the country. And he says the gold medal was a win not just for the game, but for the entire nation.
We're still in that euphoric mode. I mean, we're moving back to business. But if you look at social media, you're still seeing posts about the rugby. People are hunting YouTube to try and find any bit of the game that they can watch again. This is just something that people have been able to embrace because it's such a positive thing, you know, and that's what we've been clinging to for the last few months, anything that's positive.
The Fiji team arrives back home on Sunday, and preparations are underway for their welcome, which will be celebrated nationwide by a public holiday on Monday. This is Sally Round.
And with that report from Sally Round, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I want to remind you that you can listen to a 3-time daily edition, a 15-minute version of the program that goes out to listeners in the Pacific. If you wish to let us know what you think of this program, the weekly version, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is pcjqsl@pcjmedia.com for reception reports, or focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to this program again by visiting our website at any time, www.pcjmedia.com, and click on the link for Focus Asia Pacific, and then another link that will bring you to the program bank. You can also subscribe to this program on Stitcher Smart Radio and through iTunes. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you all, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.